Well, hello there, fellow music obsessives. We found each other. This is episode 45 of the Planet LP podcast. I am Ted Asfergadu, and I'm going to do something a little bit different in this episode. I went through my audio archives. Yeah, I've got audio archives. Anybody who worked in radio for a long period of time, like I have, you collect a lot of stuff. These audio archives are from when I hosted a weekly public affairs program on a group of radio stations in the San Francisco Bay Area. And these programs ran the gamut from hyper-local issues to sometimes national politics to this particular interview that I want to spotlight. It's with a guy named Daniel Levitin, who is now a neuroscientist and a cognitive psychologist. He's a best-selling author of the book called This Is Your Brain on Music: The Science of a Human Obsession. Now, this particular book came out in August 2007. That was kind of a long time ago, but it was fascinating to me as a music obsessive. And that's why I want to feature it in this episode, because I think you're going to find it pretty fascinating as well. We had a long-ranging discussion about music and how it affects our brains and when our brains actually kind of close down in terms of being open to new experiences. And it's quite revealing, because sometimes as we age, we tend to look back on the music of our youth as the best, right? Nobody did it better than when we were young and the kind of music we were listening to. Well, there's a reason for that. And Daniel Levitin will talk about it in the interview. But before we get started, how about we get social with each other? Facebook, it's Planet LP. Twitter and Instagram, The Planet LP. Spotify, I'm at Ted Asfergadu. That's spelled A-S-R-E-G-A-D-O-O. And you can always get in touch with me via email at ted@planetlp.com. And if you're listening to this podcast for the first time, please subscribe. We're on all the major podcasting platforms, so wherever you listen to your podcasts, Planet LP is probably there. So with that, let's get going with This Is Your Brain on Music. Weird listening back to old audio recordings of yourself. Now, 2007 for some may not seem like that long ago, but upon reflection, yeah, it was kind of a long time ago. So this is taken from a show that I had hosted called In Focus, and it was for KKIQ Radio that's located in Pleasanton, California. Yes, the radio station still exists. I don't know if they do this program anymore. I doubt it, but it was mine to host, and I took the reins and crafted it and shaped it the way I wanted to. And one of the things that came down the pike was this book from Daniel Levitin called This Is Your Brain on Music. Now, I mention his name for a couple of reasons. One, because the book is really good, but two, there is a San Francisco Bay Area connection. When I initially interviewed him and I sent my pitch email, he immediately said, absolutely, hey, my hometown radio station. I didn't understand what he meant about that. But as it turned out, he was from the Bay Area, specifically Contra Costa County, and one of the radio stations that this broadcast on, which is called KKDV, which is still in existence, the transmitter is located in Lafayette, California, which is near his hometown of Moraga. Now, there's another Bay Area connection that Dan Levitin had, and it was when I had Bill Kopp on to talk about 415 Records. Now, if you haven't heard that episode, go ahead and listen to it. I don't mention Dan in that episode, but if you read Bill's book, you'll find out that Dan Levitin, back in the 80s, was the A&R person for 415 Records. So he has deep music connections to the Bay Area, and that music obsessiveness took him into his current line of research, or at least partially so. So without further ado, here's me from 2007 talking to Daniel Levitin about your brain on music. Good morning, I'm Ted Asfergadu, and this morning on In Focus, I welcome Daniel Levitin. He is a professor at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. He runs the Laboratory for Musical Perception, Cognition, and Expertise. He's the author of the new book, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, and it's published by Dutton. But Daniel is also a local boy who made good. He is from Moraga and was for a long time a working musician, producer, and engineer right here in the Bay Area. And we're going to be talking about the effects of music on our brains. Good morning, Daniel. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Well, good morning, Ted. Thanks for having me on the show.
After reading your book, I think I understand the structure of the genres of music I generally listen to. Now, the stations I work for basically play pop music, pop being short for popular.
Yeah.
And you've worked in the music business before you started working in academics. So question, what is it about the music we hear on stations like KKIQ or KKDV that makes it so pleasing to our ears?
What's happening is that the composers of the music are coming up with just the right balance between novelty and familiarity,
mm-hmm.
and between complexity and simplicity. If music is too familiar or too simple, we tune it out because it's boring. And at the other extreme, if it's too novel, with no familiar elements at all, we find that we can't ground ourselves to it, we don't have any frame of reference, and so it's too complicated for us to process. A good song really hits the balance right in the middle. And if it hits the balance right, you can listen to it for the rest of your life and still find it rewarding.
You know, when you worked in the music business, you certainly were a working musician. You engineered bands. You produced bands. When somebody comes in with a demo and they say, well, here's a song, and you're listening to it, what is it about certain things that you have found just working in the music business? And you can bring in your work as an academic as well on this one, that you're saying, okay, guys, here's what I hear, and here's how we can make it better. Are there certain elements that you can put in that will make the song a little bit more pleasing to our ears?
I think so. And of course, the trick there is that you want to add things that will serve the art, not just the commerce. I mean, there are record producers and bands that are in it for the money,
mm-hmm.
and they'll pull out anything they can from their bag of tricks to make it sell. And I always took a different approach, having started out as a musician myself. The music was the most important thing, but on the other hand, if nobody ever hears it, it doesn't do any good.
Right, right.
So you want to put in some things that you know will make it more pleasing and make it more accessible, but you don't want to go too far.
Because then you become like everybody else, and they say, sounds just like X, or that sounds just like Y.
Yeah, it sounds like you're selling out or that you've lost some of the novelty, which mm-hmm. is what makes it rewarding. But in terms of the specifics of what those things are, well, a verse is supposed to be separate from a chorus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're supposed to be able to tell. It goes into the refrain that the music has changed.
It helps, right?
And you look for emotional dynamics. You look for music that breathes. Music, like life, speeds up a bit and it slows down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit complicated. It's a bit simple. It has an emotional trajectory, and a good book and a good film and a good life have that too. You don't want everything pedal to the metal all the time. And so a song should breathe both in terms of its rhythms and in terms of its emotional message. You want to feel a payoff somewhere in the song, a real emotional release.
You know, this gets to my second question, and that is something that you talked about early on, which was the repetition of patterns in music. It's something that we find comforting at some level. We can anticipate what's going to happen, and we can sing along or play air guitar or play air drums to certain songs. But in your book, you say it's the lack of prediction that makes for excitement when it comes to music. Now, some songs you really have to listen very closely to hear the variations in the dominant patterns, but other songs will take you in directions that sound very different, yet it doesn't turn people off. And I'm thinking of a song by Yes that came out in the early 80s called Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Yeah.
And that song just, it has like stop time, and suddenly, you know, these instruments come out blaring out of nowhere, and it's just like, what is this? And I remember I was in high school at the time when this song came out, and it was unlike any other song in the top 40. That's a song to me that a lot of people kept listening to it over and over because they said, this is weird, but I like it.
So that's a good example, because there were repetitious elements within sections.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got John Anderson singing, Owner of a Lonely Heart, and
right.
then the guitar, ba-na-dum, ba-na-dum. So that becomes kind of a hook that you can hang on to, and you know that that's going to come back. But then they have these crazy edits where they suddenly go into another part of the song with mm-hmm. no transition, and that's what I think made it exciting. So you have the balance there. You have these traditional elements like the drums are beating and they're keeping a good beat throughout and so on.
But then you have other songs that you hear and they sound very familiar. Like you can hear, for example, the White Stripes. To me, the first time I ever heard the White Stripes, I said, that sounds like the Kinks.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just like, oh my gosh. And I talked to a friend of mine who's also a music critic. And I said, when you listen to the White Stripes, do you hear the Kinks? And he said, well, you're older than me, so I don't. So, but there again, there was some familiarity to it, but it was sort of brought back in sort of repackaged in a way in a new form. And it to ears who had never heard of the Kinks before, suddenly the White Stripes come out and they think it's fresh, it's new, it's exciting. It's something unlike we've ever heard in the last, 10 years, 12 years for the generation that was coming into their musical maturity. So, I mean, it's songs like Owner of a Lonely Heart and songs to me that are just very basic in many ways. But I think what happens is that the musical landscape, in terms of radio, you tend to a certain style of music becomes dominant. Suddenly something comes along that catches your ear, and program directors and music directors start adding it and record labels start pushing it. And the public suddenly just says, wow, I like the way this is going. And then it just switches gears all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's interesting. And yet altogether, if you look at pop music from 1958 to now, I think you see, if you follow year by year, you see that really what characterizes popular music, creativity, I would say it's evolution rather than revolution. Although, you know, it seems like when Prince came along, he was revolutionary, or when the White Stripes or Death Cab for Cutie came up, they seem revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Or the band X.
I loved X.
really, it's an evolution.
Yeah.
And although, depending on how much music you know and how old you are, you may not always hear the influences. The artist can sit down and show you. I was with Paul Simon a couple of years ago, and I was saying, oh, you know, just this stuff comes from out of nowhere. You don't sound like anybody else. And he says, well, you just don't know what I'm stealing from. Well, show me. And he did. And he sat down and he played me some Sam Cooke B-sides that I had never heard before. And I went, oh, my God, that you're Sam Cooke. That's where it came from. I didn't know. So sometimes the stuff just seems to fall from out of the sky. And it's not completely falling from out of the sky, because if it did, we wouldn't like it. There has to be something familiar in there. And it never diminishes my view when I hear somebody's influences, because what I think I appreciate is how cleverly they stood on the shoulders of the previous artists and still came up with something new. When you listen to the Beatles doing Revolution Number One, or you listen to Back in the USSR, These are blues songs, and they're borrowing very heavily from Chuck Berry and the Beach Boys, and you know that. But there's so much new stuff in there that you don't care.
That you like it anyway. You're listening to In Focus. I hope you like what you're listening to. I'm Ted Asfergato, and my guest this morning is Daniel Levitin. He is a professor of psychology at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. He's also the author of the new book, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. Like many Americans, Daniel, I have a blog where I post thoughts on a number of things, but one of the topics I frequently blog on is music. Now, I did a post the other day that was based in part on your book, and that was songs that we become obsessed with. Now, for me, there are a few songs that I can't get out of my head. There's a couple from Led Zeppelin. There's a couple Dire Straits songs, a band from Portland called Antlerand. And then some people commented about the songs that I was talking about, but they added their own. But it made me wonder if you had some thoughts about why certain songs can be played over and over and we don't really tire of them. Does it have to do what you wrote about in your book about the turning point for music preferences in our lives around 14 years old, that we suddenly develop these tastes and it coincides with things that are going on in our brain, but also things that are going on socially? Or is there other things as well?
Well, I think there are two factors there, Ted. First, it's as you say, as I try to draw out in the book, what we've learned about the brain is that the brain is developing new connections for the first several years of life.
Mm-hmm.
But around the age of 10, the primary mission of the brain stops being to make new connections and to start getting rid of the ones it turns out it didn't need. So the music that you're hearing between the ages of, say, 10 and 14 literally becomes wired into your brain.
Mm.
And it becomes the template that you compare all other music to as you grow up, as you grow older. So it doesn't mean that you'll always like that music, but that is sort of the base, the foundation on which you base your further musical preferences. So songs from that era are ones that will hold a certain appeal for you. particularly if you can find somebody who plays around with those early schemas. So for me, and my generation, there's a guy named Owsley, a songwriter, and there's another songwriter, Amy Mann, who sort of sound like they're doing what the Beatles would have done if they had formed 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a sucker for that stuff because I was imprinted on the Beatles, and so when I hear somebody doing something special with it and taking it to the next dimension, that really resonates with me. Now, the second factor, in addition to brain development in terms of what gets stuck in your head or why you can come back to something for many, many years
mm-hmm.
and still find enjoyment, that second factor has to do with these schemas that you develop and how they're violated. So you've got a schema, and this is a sort of a buzzword that we use in cognitive science, meaning a template
mm-hmm.
in your brain for pop songs. And even though you happen to be a musician, but even if a person was not, they might not be able to say, oh, I know that pop songs tend to have 8-bar phrases, and when they go to the chorus, they tend to go to the 4-chord or the 5-chord. You might not be able to describe it that way, but you know it when you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know
mm-hmm.
that this meets your expectations. Well, take a song like Yesterday by the Beatles, just as one example.
Okay.
That doesn't have 8-bar phrases. The phrases are 7 bars. One of very few songs in the whole pop literature that has the 7-measure phrase. So what that means is that you've heard thousands of songs that have 8-measure phrases. There's this one that doesn't meet that expectation. And so that's that novelty, one of many novel aspects of it, makes it interesting for you, and it can make it interesting for the rest of your life, even if you've heard the song thousands of times and you know that it has 7-bar phrases. It's still relatively less common, and it's unexpected in the general sense when you compare it to all the other music that's out there.
You made that point also in your book as well about a couple of other songs that weren't pop songs, as you know, in terms of a top 40 charting song, but songs that played with the time signatures, because we're used to the what they call the 4-4 time, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
And one was Money by Pink Floyd, and the other was Salisbury Hill by Peter Gabriel.
Yeah.
Both songs are great songs, and it's almost like a trivia question. Name a popular song that was in 7-4 time. Well,
right.
That would be Money by Pink Floyd.
Well, and that one's harder to tap your foot to because
it is.
Of the 7-4, but it sticks in your head because it's uniqueness.
Something else that you wrote in your book, and that is this notion of the attack. It's a concept, or at least it's a word we ascribe to something like when you hit a drum, you hear that crack. The first initial crack, that first burst of sound that you hear is called the attack.
Yeah.
And then everything else that comes after it was called the steady state.
Well, the steady state or the decay, depending
or the decay.
On what happens next.
So when you hit a cymbal or when a saxophone blares, that first burst that gives the particular character
yeah.
of an instrument that comes forth. You talked about, I think it was either a scientist or an academic, who took out the first part of that attack
yeah.
to just give a sense of what the instrument would sound like without that characteristic. And
yeah,
then you said
you're talking about the cut bell experiment.
The
by
cut
Pierre
bell,
Schaeffer.
Yes.
Yeah,
that was fascinating because what you wrote about was the fact that these instruments started to become, you couldn't tell what they were after a while when you cut out that first burst of what they, you know, the attack, if you will.
It is fascinating. So much of what we think of as the sound of a trumpet is that initial 50 milliseconds, 50 thousandths of a second, where the lips are just flapping against each other in that little metal mouthpiece, and they create this kind of sound.
Right.
And then if you cut that off and you listen to it, it's indistinguishable from a piano or a clarinet.
Which I would love to hear the audio of that. Maybe I'll Google it. Maybe somebody's loaded it up on the web or something like that.
Yeah, if they have it, I will. Actually,
okay.
I have a website for the book called yourbrainonmusic.com, and I'm constantly updating it, so that's a good idea for me to put on.
That would be great. Well, I'll definitely be visiting that. And I have one more question. There was another fascinating discovery that was made, and you chronicled it in your book, was the effects music has on infants, specifically the preferences and recognition of songs that a mother may have listened to when the child was in the womb. Now, if I can personalize this for a moment, my daughter had colic for the first 5 months after she was born, and every night, like clockwork, it was a scream fest. And, you know, my wife and I, we couldn't completely calm her down, but we were able to sort of decrease the intensity
yeah.
of the crying by rocking her
yeah.
while singing along to a CD. So I started picking the same group of songs to play and sing, and one was an Elvis Costello song that actually Amy Mann, you talked about her earlier.
Oh, the the other end of the telescope.
On the other end of the telescope that she had done. But this was the Elvis Costello version.
Yeah.
And when we moved across the country, we didn't have access to our CDs for about a month. And then one day, we got the car, we had our car shipped out, and the CD, that Elvis Costello CD, was in the player. And my daughter was in the back seat, and she was kind of fussy, and the song came on. It wasn't planned or anything. It just came on. Just instantly just stopped whatever she was doing and just transfixed by this song.
That's excellent.
Instantly calmed her down. I was just like, whoa.
What a great story.
Talk about the power of music right there, you know? I mean, and it just reminded me of what you were talking about in your book, and that is infants have memory and recognition of songs, and they have a preference for certain songs. So, I mean, I know it was a long-winded explanation, but maybe you could sort of fill in the blanks of something that I left blank in terms of how that works.
You described it really vividly. We know that infants are hearing music in the womb through the amniotic fluid. It sounds something like listening underwater, but they're getting a lot of the structure and the form and the chords of music that way. And then after they're born, they show a preference for music that they heard in the womb. You know, this is a time when the brain is developing and it's trying to make sense of the world. The brain starts out as a blank slate, more or less, and it responds to any inputs it gets, particularly in the first few months of life. It wires itself up to accommodate whatever inputs it's getting. So those first few years of life, if you want your children to have really rich musical lives later, the key is to play them as many different kinds of music as you can get your hands on. Doesn't mean they'll like it all, but it'll give them the opportunity to assimilate it all.
We have to leave it there. Daniel, I want to thank you so much for a fascinating discussion this morning on In Focus.
Thank you, Ted.
Daniel Levitin is a professor at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. Daniel runs the Laboratory for Musical Perception, Cognition, and Expertise. He's also the author of the new book, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. It's published by Dutton. And that's In Focus for another week. Thanks for joining me. I'm Ted Asregutti. Well, that was fun in a kind of let's go back down memory lane kind of way. I hope you enjoyed that. I enjoyed bringing it to you. And thanks for listening. I'll be back soon talking about music right here on the Planet LP podcast. So long for now.